Welcome to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and during this semi-weekly radio show, I'll be taking you on a tour of environment, ecology, sustainability, and society through interviews and discussions with academics, activists, advocates, agency staff, and maybe even artists, talking about their programs and projects and goals and dreams and desires. Our focus will be primarily on the Monterey Bay region, but sometimes we will range as far afield as California and beyond. Today, my guest is Thomas Rettenwender, principal architect at the Ecologic Design Lab in Carmel, California. And we're going to talk about green buildings, green construction, ADUs, tiny houses, things like that. Thomas holds a master's in architecture from the University for Applied Arts in Vienna and is a LEED accredited professional. He's taught courses in green building design at UCSC, Hartnell, San Jose Community College, and Monterey Peninsula Community College, among other places. Ecologic Design Lab is an architectural and ecological design lab providing innovative, sustainable, and educational architectural design services in and around the Monterey Bay area, as well as internationally. So, Thomas, I always like to start the programs with asking my guests about their background, how they ended up becoming, what they're doing, and maybe, you know, some pointers for people who might be looking for careers or for changing careers, how you got into this business.
Yes, okay. Well, thanks so much, Ronnie, for inviting me to this this radio show. A little bit about my background. I was born in Europe, in Munich, Germany, and went through schooling in a few different countries. I was kind of in a track to go to university, and I did have a keen interest in architecture, but didn't really have, didn't know where to begin. I went to study philosophy and mathematics at Trinity College in Dublin, and that was, I thought, somehow related to architecture in a way. And then gaining this quite theoretical training in philosophy and mathematics, I did some more practical training at the Dublin Institute of Technology and learned how to draw like roof trusses and whatnot, and then went on to finish that degree, and I went to work on the construction sites. That's where the pay was quite good, and it was easy to get a job on the construction sites, especially with an Irish accent in Berlin at the time. I was fascinated by the tools involved in building structures, the technology, but also the creative aspect of designing buildings. I was quite fortunate, being Austrian, I was able to study architecture at the University of Applied Arts, and the tuition was basically free, funded by the government. So I pretty much put myself through college, covering my own living expenses, but the tuition wasn't there, so I was really fortunate to have that. And
you ended up at Ecologic Design Lab, but were you a part of one of the founders?
And yes.
How did that happen?
Yes. Well, I ended up in California in Big Sur working for an architect there, Mickey Munich, who did some phenomenal work, amazing design architecture tradition there in Big Sur, and that's really how I learned how to build things at university. They teach you very theoretical concepts, grand schemes. But at Mickey Munich's office in Big Sur, I really learned how to work with the materials, and also very particular to Big Sur is a lot of difficult sites, a lot of steep slopes, and topography that you need to work with. After doing my apprenticeship there with Mickey Munich, I started my own firm, the Ecologic Design Lab, and that was founded around 2010. So, Yeah, the Ecologic Design Lab has been my focus, my main focus for nearly 10 years now. And what we do is try to combine the more traditional skills and services of architecture, combine those with an ecological design approach, where we consider a lot of the different systems on a building site or on a piece of land, and try to harmonize and coordinate those systems as much as possible.
Yeah, I was going to ask if maybe you could talk a little bit about the broader philosophy of green design, what it is, and you know, how you approach it, because it's not just a matter of putting up a structure with all kinds of certified, environmentally certified materials. So maybe you could say a little bit about that.
Yes. You know, certainly green building design really became a focus near about 10, 15 years ago, where we were really realizing the improvements that we can make in our homes and in our buildings. And just observing, watching this progress in green building design over the last 10 years has been fascinating. A lot of those concepts have been integrated into the normal building code, the more normal building standards that we now have. However, you know, green building design is not just about being more efficient. It's a lot broader than that. And, you know, I think sustainable design is another good term for it, where we're looking at trying to achieve sustainability. And again, it's not just the efficiencies that we're after. A lot of these building rating systems, they address the efficiencies, energy efficiency, water conservation, and whatnot. But I think it's a lot broader than that, where we, you know, we think about the human body and the human comfort, but also the landscape, how we integrate and live with the landscape. Ken Yang wrote this amazing book called The Eco Design Manual, and he talks about, it takes a very visionary approach, and he talks about the seamless integration of the built environment and the natural environment, where, that we observe and learn and integrate the natural systems that are occurring in nature, and enhance our buildings that way. So it can get quite deep and conceptual in, you know, how you approach a site and how you install or bring a new structure into a site, a piece of land.
Well, I mean, that raises in my mind a question. As you know, I'm interested in the urban environment in particular, because so many people live in cities, right? And so if you're going, you know, if you're confronted with a plot of land in an urban setting, how do you think about green design? About this kind of philosophy we were just talking about, Ken Yang's sign of view. How do you integrate with landscape when you're surrounded by houses, pedestrian houses often?
Yes. Well, urban design, talking about urban design is fascinating, and it really highlights, the benefits of sustainable design or ecological design. I mean, in an urban setting, there are so many different systems that you are working with. Rather than, you know, in a purely natural setting, there's a lot of systems with the land already. But in an urban site, you have a lot of different views and maybe more traffic and more systems, urban systems to deal with, and ecological design, you know, that those principles apply very well, because, you know, like I said, they're, what you're trying to do is integrate these different systems and make them harmonize, make them work together. In urban design, it also has a very emotional sort of human aspect to it as well, which we shouldn't forget. It's about what happens in a city and what happens when people live close to one another, what happens with traffic and, the density of an urban environment.
But to continue on that, right, I mean, the other thing about building in an urban environment is the sort of plethora of regulations and restrictions. And I know that cities all over California, at least, have been updating their permitting systems and their building regulations and things like that. And they're required by the state to do this as well, right? I wanted to ask you about the state of green building in California and the standards. But still, people have trouble, especially the ones who have to review plans and grant permits. They have trouble often trying to figure out what's going on. Do you find that that's a, is that something that delays, building a green building? What's your experience with that in that respect?
Well, certainly, yeah. I mean, if we think back 15 years ago when green building design was kind of new on the scene, I think since then we've integrated a lot of these green building standards, and also it's become a lot more difficult to get the permits. The permitting process has become more complicated, and it's included many different more aspects. And it certainly is a challenge. I think the sustainable design or sustainable development is often equated to like a zero growth or no growth. I think in this central California, in this area, there's a lot of, in my opinion, misunderstanding between zero, no growth, and sustainable development, sustainable growth. Density is not a bad thing. If it's handled in the right way with the right infrastructure. The regulatory process has made construction, design, made it more difficult, more expensive. It's debatable whether it's really made it better. But it's certainly a necessary evil that if we want to live together, build together in an urban environment and in our towns, cities, we need guidelines to help us sort of coordinate what your neighbor is building or how your town is shaped. It's a lot of what I do is sort of navigate the regulatory process and get permits, and sometimes people get in trouble for not doing it correctly or not doing it at all, and so I try to help them out of that, but it's almost a process, a science unto itself, getting these permits.
Mm-hmm. Related to that, when you have a design, architectural design, do you encounter trouble when you bring the designs, the blueprints, to builders? We have more and more companies that claim they're green builders. But if you come with some sort of unusual design which has been approved, do you always get what you want? To quote the Rolling Stones.
All right. Well, you certainly don't. And I think it's been interesting to watch coming from sort of a training in architecture at a sort of a international architecture school, coming to California, a lot of what we build and design these days is really simplified, and it's dumbed down because of budgetary concerns, because of the regulatory process, I mentioned Mickey Munich, who designed and built down in Big Sur. So he would build his houses, beautiful houses, for $60,000 back in the 70s, and today they would cost $6 million. So it's, I think just the cost of construction has just really, really gone up significantly. So it's really affected our freedom as architects and designers.
Okay. You're listening to KSQD in Santa Cruz at 90.7 FM and KSQD.org on the web. And this is Sustainability Now. KSQD thanks the following donors for their support of the programs you hear on K-Squid: Shalom Compost, Tim Folger, Michael Lasnabat, Andrea London, Brian Miller, and Jennifer Young. There are many others. You inspire us to give you our very best at 97.FM 90.7 FM, may you also inspire others to donate on our website, ksqd.org. Now let's get back to our show. I'm speaking with Thomas Rettenwender, who is principal architect at Ecologic Design Lab in Carmel, California. Let's see. Can you tell us a little bit about the kinds of one or two projects that you've designed and how the process of getting them built was? Because again, you know, and not something that was really fancy, but something that was, you know, how can I say, not more pragmatic, but, you know, scale.
Well, yes. One project that we built here nearby is in Bonny Doon. It's the Slot Over Residence, and it's actually quite neat. It was a straw bale construction, and the contractor, Carl Barris, lives close to the site there in Bonny Doon, and he milled the redwood beams on his property and brought them over, and the whole house is kind of shaped to optimize passive solar gain. It's in the wooded area, and so the house is laid out on a polar grid to face the sun as it moves across the sky. And it was fascinating. The project was fascinating because it was a raw piece of land when we got there. And Ben, the owner, and I, we camped out in the middle of fields of brush, right at the beginning, and it was quite a process. It took, I think, seven or eight years to actually get the house built, just because of all the infrastructure that we needed to, the well, the water system, and the septic system, the driveway, the fire hydrant, and whatnot. Yeah, apart from the house itself, that took quite a bit of time as well. But that was, you know, just a really wonderful, gratifying experience to build a beautiful straw bale house in Bonny Doon with Carl Barris. Yeah, and another project that I've designed that's quite a large scale is the Monterey Bay Shores Eco Resort. It's a 350 unit eco resort down in in the beginning of Monterey Bay on the coast. That's theoretically under construction, but I think it's you know, it's a longer term project. But we've also built several tiny houses in the past. In the past few years, we've sort of followed and been leaders in the tiny house design movement, trying to push that boundary a little bit, and also working with students, sort of in an educational setting, to inspire other younger folks to take the power tools and, you know, design something and build it as well. So that's been also very exciting.
Yeah, well, why don't we can move and talk about tiny houses. And in particular, I know that you've been working on a project with the Veterans Transition Center out at Fort Ord to build a tiny house village. Maybe you could say, you know, tell us something about that and about where it stands. And I'm particularly interested in how homeless veterans play a role in all of this.
Yes. We've, you know, over the past four or five years, we've put together curricula regarding tiny house design and construction. And we've also reached out to several local organizations. And one of them is the VTC, Veterans Transition Center, and they have a great history and a great track record of helping homeless veterans in various different forms, and they do have some property down in the former Fort Ord area. Martinez Hall is their headquarters, and they have several residential houses, and they want to expand and integrate the concept of tiny houses. I think what's appealing to them is the smaller units that can be built in a more affordable way, and They can be installed on the site, maybe even in between the existing houses, or in sort of a village setting where these smaller structures are sharing resources, creating just creating that village sort of feel. Mm-hmm. And I believe, you know, in helping homeless folks, the community aspect is really important to create sort of a feeling of support and community involvement. And that's where the BTC has been very successful in offering so-called wraparound services, where there's a hospital nearby. They help homeless with food, and they help them with bus passes and counseling and whatnot. So it would be a great place to see an expansion of homeless services and homeless housing for the homeless as well. Eventually, even to get folks not only off the streets, but into a form of home ownership themselves, where they could participate in the construction of a tiny house, maybe thereby gaining some credits and eventually owning one themselves and being able to sort of transition into their own ownership of a house. And
We should make clear that these are not tiny houses on wheels, right? These are... I thought the ones that you're proposing are fixed foundation, aren't they?
Or yes, well, that's always sort of a question in our minds. You know, the tiny houses on wheels, they are all of, you know, immediately classified in a different category, and they come with different sort of complications. The city of Marina, for example, they don't want you know, folks parking on the public streets and living there, and that might be a concern to them, is that if this house is on wheels, it could end up anywhere pretty much. But it does have that added benefit of it being flexible. It can be moved, and it's you know, it's just a lot more flexible that way. That it if it's built on wheels, then, you know, there's it can be on any number of sites, and if it's a problem, it can be moved down the street.
So, I mean, is your village going to be a village of tiny houses on wheels, or not?
So, in working with the city of the city of Marina, the tiny houses on wheels are too controversial. So, are thinking of the fixed foundation model, although that is changing. I think people are becoming more accustomed and more open to this type of housing structure, which is not, you know, we try to differentiate a tiny house on wheels from a camper or an RV or these other, or a mobile home even. You know, I really understand a tiny house on wheels to be something that's custom made, has, it shows natural materials. It really sparks the imagination, because homeowners can build them themselves, and there's a whole you know, there's millions of YouTube videos of folks building these structures, and it has become a bit of a movement, and really a source of inspiration for many looking for affordable housing, is to take on, you know, a tiny house construction themselves, and as we have done too at the college and here at UC Santa Cruz as well.
Yeah, well, a few years ago there was a big sort of fad about housing the homeless in tiny houses, right? And the question that I always asked was, and where are you going to put them? And I don't know that particular issue ever got addressed. So we're now seeing the city of Oakland has these lots with sheds on them, right? And various kinds of, you know, various kinds of strategies, especially for the homeless. I don't see tiny houses on wheels as quite as fashionable as they were. And I think part of that was because of, you know, so you give someone a house, they still don't have land, where are they going to put it? And so the VTC center, of course, would have the land underneath it, right? And that seems like a key issue. But it also brings us to this sort of, you know, question of the general housing crisis up and down the California coast, which is largely driven by the cost and unavailability of land for new houses and even for multiple buildings with multiple dwellings. And so have you been doing any kind of work around what are called accessory dwelling units?
Yes. I have been doing work in that area, and I've been following that the progression. I think it was a good 10 years ago, the city of Santa Cruz actually had a catalog of about five or six designs that one could pick up, and if you liked it, you could skip some of the regulatory process and go ahead and build these pre-established designs. We're doing one in Seaside right now, where I live down in the other side of the Monterey Bay. And this ADU is playing a critical role where the main house is being rented out as an Airbnb, and we have in Seaside, there's a rule that the homeowner needs to live on the property in order to rent out the Airbnb. And so the owner has his son living in this ADU in the back and renting out the front house for quite a bit of money for a 3-bedroom house. So the ADU, I think we talked about this already. The ADU is supposed to help the housing shortage, but in this case, it does that, but it also alleviates or enables more short-term rental properties to happen.
Yeah, well, for reasons I won't go into here, I've been doing a lot of research on accessory dwelling units recently. Santa Cruz tried to liberalize its rules about 20 years ago, and then did this tried to do this project with standardized designs. And my understanding is that almost no one took the city up, and that was because the process was so drawn out and difficult to get through. And so the state of California is now mandating various kinds of more liberal regulations, and cities are going to be required to follow them. Now, whether that actually leads to an explosion in ADUs, there was a piece in the Chronicle, front page of the San Francisco Chronicle this morning about this. This is the solution. So it may end up being another fad, unless some of the obstacles can be addressed. We need to take a break. So you're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 97.0 FM and online ksqd.org in Santa Cruz. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Thomas Rettenwender, Principal Architect at Ecologic Design Lab in Carmel, California. And we'll be right back after this quick break.
What's for dinner, honey?
Something special tonight, dear. Squid!
Squid?
That's right, K-Squid.
KSQD, Santa Cruz Community Radio, on 90.7.
It's What's for Dinner.
Hi, I'm Adele Durant.
And I'm Jean Kratzer.
We're the alternate host of Exploring Santa Cruz.
Whether you're new to Santa Cruz
or have spent your whole life here,
Exploring Santa Cruz will shine a new light
on the familiar,
the unexpected,
the overlooked,
and the emerging people, issues, and profiles.
Join us every other Monday from 3:30 to 4 p.m.
on KSQD 90.7 FM.
Many voices,
one community station.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now. My guest today is Thomas Rettenwender, Principal Architect at Ecologic Design Lab in Carmel, California. Thomas, when I read your brief bio at the beginning of the show, I mentioned that you're a LEED accredited professional. And maybe you can tell us what LEED is and what that means, that you're an accredited professional.
Yes. So LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, and it's a green building rating system that came out of the U.S. Green Building Council. It must be a good 15 years old now or so. I did go through the process of becoming an accredited professional, and I found it very interesting and helpful to go through that process to get a really good overview of green building methods that are around today. I haven't found it extremely relevant in sort of the residential construction world. However, I did find it to be quite helpful as an introduction or a good overview of green building methods. Yeah, I think, you know, like I said earlier, it LEED does well to address the efficiency of the houses that we and buildings that we design. You know, it doesn't go into the it doesn't take a very holistic approach as far as the human involvement or the human being in our buildings. You know, I think, you know, working with the landscape and, you know, designing our structures, our buildings so that they're integrated, you know, I think it does require a broader and a deeper understanding of design in order to create a successful structure or a structure or a house.
Yeah, actually, you made an interesting point, and it's one that I've been acquainted with for about 40 years now, which is that you can do all that you want to design a structure according to various kinds of standards and goals, and if you have the wrong people in the structure, it won't work. You know, and there's an old saying, it's difficult to make things foolproof because fools are such clever people. And I mean, this is also an engineering problem. You know, basically, you know, you come up with a design for something that you really think is great, and then you find out that no one wants it. And so the problem with LEED, I understand, is that it examines systems and materials and the way things are set up, but doesn't say much about how people operate within the building. And I think, you know, my observation is that that's becoming more important. There's a lot of research going on about behavior, you know, human behavior in buildings, especially as it's related to energy. Whether this has actually changed any behavior, that's, of course, another question. But California has introduced or is introducing new green building standards. Have you? I'm sure you've become familiar with those. And can you tell us about, you know, when they're going to go into effect, and is that going to make your job easier or more difficult, or what?
Yes. Well, you know, I think the green building standards, the building standards in general, have integrated more and more green building concepts as the years have progressed. Energy efficiency is a big one. The zero net energy concept that's gone into effect at the beginning of this year. The new code has started the beginning of this year. It encourages, demands, requires that new construction provides its own energy through a renewable source, and it's actually quite a game changer because you know, not only we're not assuming that the energy is coming from the power grid, but we're as a standard, as a rule, we're integrating the process of generating that electricity in our homes and our buildings as well. And, you know, I see this going way beyond just putting solar panels on your roof, but we can integrate those photovoltaic cells in our walls, in our pavement, in our glass. So, you know, I'm really fascinated by this concept of building integrated photovoltaics where those photovoltaics are sort of integrated into the structure of the house, not just slapped on in the form of a solar panel.
Do the new standards actually require new housing to have solar panels? Is that part of the, or is that an option with alternatives? I'm sort of interested in hearing about zero net energy, because it's not really zero. It doesn't mean that the house uses no energy.
Right.
It means that There's no external energy coming in from the grid or from you know, via natural gas, right? I mean, that's what it means.
Right.
Or does it mean something different?
Well, in practice, what it is that your house is tied to the electrical grid, but it's producing the power and it feeds the grid as much as your house is actually using. So what they're attempting to do is zero out your energy bill or the net. At the end of the year, the net usage is equal to, you know, to the amount of energy you've produced. So that's quite an efficient way of doing it. You're not oversizing your solar system. And you know, I think also if you realize that you're producing the power, you also become more efficient with how you use it.
Well, I wonder about that one, because basically the grid becomes your storage, right? And if you don't, you know, if you're not extremely conscientious about watching what you use, right, and watching what you then draw from the grid, you know, it's as if you had nothing at all. Again, I'm showing my age, but I had an experience with solar heating about 40 years ago at Massachusetts Audubon, and I learned from that. You know, that's where I learned about the fools and the, you know, clever people stuff, because I won't talk about it, but I had a unpleasant experience there. And so really, you know, you have to, there has to be some kind of measurement system there that people can pay attention to so that they know really what's going on. I imagine that's going to be part of the requirement too. Going back to this, a couple of years ago, PG&E announced that it was not going to accept electricity from any more solar houses or something like that, because there were too many online and they weren't paying their fair share of the grid and it was destabilizing the power system. I don't, you know, I haven't heard anything about that. PG&E has much bigger problems, of course. I haven't heard anything about that lately. But this, you know, seems to me to be something that the utilities, the private utilities, might not be particularly happy with. Do you know anything about that?
Yes. No, it is true that the status quo utility suppliers, when you start to become more efficient with, you know, the resources and you start to produce them yourself, then these companies, they have trouble sort of integrating that. So, you know, there's a concept called the duck curve where, you know, when a lot of people have solar panels, there's all this power coming into the grid during the day. And then in the evening, when everybody wants the power, all that power is gone. It's not being produced anymore. So the solar companies are, the PG&E, I think, is that's one of the things they somehow struggle with, is how to regulate and regulate all the power coming in and feeding that demand. Water companies as well, you know, in the Monterey area, it's been a big controversy because people are becoming a lot more efficient with their water use, but the water companies are raising the rates regardless, because they say, you know, you're not buying enough water from us, so we have to raise our rates. So it's these status quo utility companies are, I think, are struggling in kind of, you know, if trying to evolve but having trouble doing that.
I think that came up in the first show when I was talking to Tiffany Wise West. I seem to recall we were talking about the issue of you know, rising rates. But apropos that, a couple of years ago, I heard this really interesting thing on the radio, just, you know, at random, that the Carmel Valley Water Company was offering basically to pay for most of a rain collection storage tank for people living in the area. And I thought, you know, this is really crazy. The cost per gallon of water is astronomical. Water is still priced practically free, and you're going to start paying, you know, more money for water. And then it occurred to me that it's really the marginal cost of water, and not the average cost of water. Now, this is a, you know, something from economics, which is that we usually pay average cost for to utilities, which is averaged over a long period of time. But if you start to build a new reservoir, as they would have to do on the Carmel River, you know, it costs millions of dollars. The actual cost of capturing a gallon of water is much higher than the average. Right. And of course, if people had to pay that marginal cost, they would use a lot less water. So this is another one of the contradictions or paradoxes of all of efficiency, is that, you know, how what sorts of logics utilities start to pursue. So, I mean, what are the economics of all of this? OK, so we've been talking about green design. We've been talking about green buildings and zero net energy. And the ultimate question is, does it cost more, and how much more? Because, of course, if you're trying to build a house or if you're trying to refurbish a house, that's an important question, right? What is this going to add to the overall cost of the project?
Yes, well, I think I did mention earlier that these green building methods that have become part of the building code in this area, they do increase the costs of construction, the costs of the infrastructure. They certainly are more, you know, they do well to be more sustainable and more efficient, I think, in general. However, yeah, there is a cost involved. You know, I think it's hard to really quantify that, but. You know, going back to the tiny house movement and the ADU movement of building smaller structures, you know, and in particular the tiny houses on wheels are fascinating because they really exemplify this zero net energy concept that we were talking about, where your little tiny house on wheels will probably be producing its own power by design. And you know, the whole question of how you get power, but also the other resources like water and air become a big issue, because pretty much your tiny house on wheels has to be self-sufficient, because the goal is to be able to travel with it. And you know, how do you factor all that in to the kind of the bigger economic scale? It's hard to say, but what is really evident, I think, is that, you know, if you're designing a self-sufficient structure that doesn't really have an impact on the land, you're not, digging a big foundation. If you can achieve that, then the impact and the resource efficiency of that unit is going to be so much higher than your standard, concrete with a concrete foundation. Where the resources are just coming out of the grid, you know, and you don't even feel or notice sort of where it's coming from. If you're actually producing that power and you're having to store all that water, you know, you really get a feeling for the resources that you need and how to be more efficient with them.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're schlepping it around on the freeway, I'm not quite sure how that balances out. We have to take a short break. This is KSQD in Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM, and KSQD.org on the web, the ink spot on your dial. I was thinking the other day that radio dial is such an archaic concept. Nobody has radio dials anymore, but there you go.
Buddhism, Judaism, Baha'i, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism. Sound interesting? Faith Matters is a unique bi-monthly program that explores spirituality, life, and meaning with local religious leaders. We discuss areas of common ground and also identify distinct differences among diverse spiritual perspectives. Join us on the second and fourth Sunday evening of every month from 6 to 7 as we have thought-provoking conversations about Faith Matters on 90.7 KSQD.
Hi, this is Ronnie Lipschitz with Sustainability Now. My guest today is Thomas Rettenwender from the Ecologic Design Lab in Carmel. I was just commenting to our engineer about the origins of the radio dial, that when radios were first commercialized, the way in which you tuned them was to twist basically a variable resistor. Some of you older listeners might remember those. That was, of course, in the days of analog devices. So we no longer need to have dials except as a kind of an affectation. Anyhow, enough of that. Let's get back to our topic, which is about all things green building. One of the advantages you mentioned in terms of smaller construction, one of the advantages is that the building envelope has less area, right? So that there's less surface area for energy and other things to escape. But there's also this question of the ballooning size of American houses. Nowadays, people design 3,000 square feet, and up. And of course, these are energy and resource hungry places. And someone mentioned to me the other day that the average family of four in the world lives in 100 square feet. So, we're looking at a real difference, right? People are knocking around in big houses with very few people. So there's a sense in which, the economy of smaller structures makes a lot of sense. The other thing, of course, and I'm sort of pontificating here, is that if you've got a smaller structure, there's not that many places to go in it. So you have to get out into the community, right, and start meeting people again. So there are some, other things, other benefits from that. And of course, if you've got these kinds of small structures and people can afford to live in them, they don't have to commute long distances like, from Salinas to their janitorial jobs at the university and the like. So there could be some, environmental benefits. There might be some costs as well. I asked Tiffany about this a couple of weeks ago, but there's a move afoot. It started in Berkeley, but I think it's spreading across the state to move towards electrification of residential buildings. And the argument is that natural gas produces carbon emissions. It's still a major source of energy in existing housing. And buildings are a major contributor to the state's greenhouse gas emissions and, to the state achieving its goals. And so electrification is now regarded as one way of getting off of natural gas. Now, I think I expressed my skepticism about doing that, but I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Yes. So I think the general understanding is that if you're burning gas to cook or to heat your water, that is more efficient than generating electricity and using electricity to heat either your house or the water or your food. However, I think it really matters how that electricity is being produced, and it being produced, if you do go to an all-electric system, then, that power, the electrical power, has to come from somewhere. Natural gas is certainly better than burning coal, but, I think the benefits are, A, if you can produce it in a natural gas power plant, then you can be more efficient with its production there at the plant. But even better, if there are renewable ways to generate that electricity, you're better off in many ways. So, I think a solar power plant feeding a town, and that makes perfect sense, because once you have the infrastructure in place, the power itself then is virtually free. is a free resource if once the system is in place. So we also see that in sort of more smaller scale residential structures, or in a tiny house is a good example. Once we have that solar power system, to integrate a gas system as well on top of that would be a lot more costly, and why do that if you can get those benefits from your solar power system as well?
Although you remember, and now I'll reveal a secret, when we were building a tiny house down at Cabrillo College in Watsonville, we ran up against this question of how much capacity can you get on the roof of a tiny house versus the demand in the tiny house. And we opted ultimately for LPG for cooking, and I think for heating water. By the way, we never finished the house, but because of this question of, you know, how much can you actually get on the structure, right? One of the things that you have to do if you're living in a tiny house is minimize your electricity consumption and as much as possible, right? And so, again, there's an aspect of frugality that enters into this whole idea of small structures, that if you're trying to provide your own energy, you do well to not use a lot. But that, of course, means, well, you know, you may have to go without some things that you're used to. What do you see, you know, let me ask, what do you see as the sort of, what sorts of things are you interested in designing or creating over the next, you know, 5 or 10 years?
Well, that's a really good question. I think these green building methods that we have been talking about, they are just beginning to become more integrated into our structures. I think the trend has been to take the traditional idea of a house and start adding on, slapping on solar panels or a water tank here or there. But I think, you know, if we can integrate and design these systems together with the house itself, we end up with very different looking structures, very different looking buildings. And, that's something that I'm really excited about, pushing that envelope, integrating water catchment and energy creation and habitat, natural habitat, sunlight, really working with the sunlight to capture that sunlight when we want it, but to shade that sunlight when we don't. I think in the next 5 or 10 years, I think we're going to see more and more of these building structures that really integrate these green building concepts rather than just sort of having them as appendages.
Of course, there is this observation, right, that if you look at the entire life cycle costs of a building, of a house, the most efficient one is the one that's already been built 50 years ago. And so then the idea is that rather than building something new, you try and do something with the existing structure. Of course, I know, and I won't, again, name names, I know that here in Santa Cruz we have a house that was rebuilt to be, I think, not just zero net energy, but zero energy. It's a totally passive house. But it was quite expensive, as I understand, to actually get it to that state. And so, again, there's this kind of irony to really do these things. You can't be poor. And so, last question that I have here, what can green building do for low-income families?
Well, that in a way it's a bit of an oxymoron. Green building, tends to be more expensive. How can it help the homeless? Well, but I do think that if we start looking at structures being smaller, more flexible, and lighter on the land, using less resources, and then really integrating not only the resources, but the generation of those resources in our buildings through solar panels, through rainwater catchment, through living on a portable structure. You know, those concepts can reduce the cost of construction, make housing smaller and more efficient, and you know, make housing have a lower impact on our environment. So, you know, I do think there's a lot of opportunities there. There's a lot of resistance as well in adopting these new types of building forms. You know, but I think eventually we'll see that happening. You know, maybe not here in Santa Cruz. Maybe ironically, we'll be seeing the more progressive solutions coming from other places. But then we'll be able to adopt them here eventually, I believe.
We have a couple of minutes left. Is there anything that we've left out? Anything you would like to mention?
Well, I would like to mention that. We have opened up a new event and creation space, the Carmel Makerspace. It's in downtown Carmel, and we're having our grand opening next Saturday, September 14th, from 6 to 9 p.m. And we're exhibiting some beautiful artwork and sculptures by a friend of mine. We also have a video production office there on site, and myself as an architect, you know, that's my architecture design office as well. So if anyone's interested in coming, please look us up on the Meetup platform. If you search for Carmel Makerspace, you'll be sure to find us there, and hope you can make it. There'll be some live music, belly dancing, some refreshments as well, and some beautiful artwork to take a look at. And the Carmel Makerspace, we're trying to inspire folks to make things, create things, architecture, videography, sculpture. These are all part of how we can get the tools into our own hands and create the solutions that we want to see. So hope you can make it and join us down there next Saturday.
Well, thank you very much, Thomas, for being our guest on Sustainability Now. In 2 weeks, I'm going to have Tim Goncharoff on the program. He's a zero waste program manager for the County of Santa Cruz, and we're going to talk about garbage and about the present recycling crisis, which is a result of China's National Sword Program, which has cut off imports of recyclables from the United States. And they are piling up all across the country, and nobody knows what to do with them. As Pete Seeger sang, garbage, 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 garbage. So until next time, Sustainability Now.
You've been listening to Sustainability Now at KSQD Santa Cruz. Stay tuned for Faith Matters coming up next.
The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Natural Bridges Media or KSQD's staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season.